This is an interview with Mr. Ed Maloney for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program, The Home Fronts During World War II, by Rebecca Smith at 100 Main Boulevard, East Liverpool, Ohio, on October 25th at 3 o'clock p.m. Mr. Maloney, could you give me a little background about your life, where you were born and raised?
I was born in East Liverpool in 1905.
Mm-hmm. What did your father do?
Pottery.
Worked in the pottery?
Mm-hmm.
And where did you go to school?
Liverpool, East Liverpool.
And college?
No.
No college, okay.
No college.
What about, how big was your family? Tell me a little bit about your family.
Well, I have three children. One in Chicago, one in Seattle, and one in Toledo.
All over the place, aren't they?
And one's a school teacher, one's a minister, and it's hard to tell what the other one is. She does very good, but she's she is a district something in the Girl Scouts of part of Indiana and the northwest of Ohio. And I have five grandchildren and two great-grandchildren, and of course I got a wife.
That's good. Where did you meet your wife?
In Hazleton, Pennsylvania, at a church convention in 1931. And we were married in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be strange to you, but we saw each other less than 15 times between meeting and getting married.
Oh,
because
really?
We were 360 miles away, and we didn't telephone, but you could write letters for 2 and 3 cents. and that was less expensive than having a hometown girlfriend.
Well, I guess it was, wasn't it? Do you remember any particular events that stand out in your memory that happened during your childhood? Like, for example, JFK assassination in my childhood. Do you remember anything like that?
I didn't get what that was you said that happened in your childhood.
No, excuse me. Do you remember it? Are there any major events that stand out in your childhood memory that happened?
I guess the thing I think of most is after the first war, they brought the battle tank into town just as to display it or to show it off. And
mm-hmm.
there was an old glass house that was built down where the sewage disposal is now, back of the Westgate building. And the kiln was there of that. It burned in 1895, but the kiln was there yet after 1918. And this thing knocked that kiln down, which was something big for we youngsters.
Oh, I guess
to get
so.
Out and see. I was, let's see, 18, I'd be 13 years old, so that was something for us. First tank we ever saw.
Huh.
So I guess that's one of the things that I remember quicker. And I wasn't around much. I worked at the grocery store in our neighborhood. When I was 10, I got a job like youngsters did then, sweeping around. So that meant that on Saturdays I was working instead of out
mm-hmm.
for the playing with the kids or going to football games or something. But I suppose that stands out about as much as anything as when I was young, a youngster.
How about the Depression? You were 1931, you met your wife and then married her in 1935. What do you remember about the Depression?
Well, now you're getting more of it. We had three soup's kitchens in East Liverpool, one in East End, and one up on a heights someplace and one downtown.
Orchard.
And Then they got to sending free flour out, but it would come to the central fire station and people would have to go there and get it. Although we sold flour, any of our customers that had to have it, we'd take our truck and go up and they'd be up there with their flour and we'd load it all in the truck and bring it back and deliver it to them. And people, I remember too that it's hard to realize that things happened that did in our society now. I'm thinking of one fellow in particular that he got work was slowed down in Midland, and he cut his telephone off because he didn't need that. And the next thing, he jacked his car up, which many people did because they couldn't run it, keep it up the weight off the tires for so long. And things of that sort. I had a customer who always bought great big heads of cabbage because she had five or six boys, and then she'd buy Hamburg at 15 cents a pound, and she'd wash that cabbage and put this Hamburg between them and tie it up and then bake it. And she said one day, I won't use the language she did, but she said, I can do Hamburg more darn ways than any customer you got. And we had a boy that started working for us the day after he graduated, that the only income that family had, because his father worked at the Wellsville Railroad Yards that just went. And the only income they had was the three boys raised rabbits. And they'd dress them and bring them to town and sell them. That was the income they had until the one boy started working for me the day after he graduated for $15 a week. He worked inside a while and then he drove a truck.
Okay, now what exactly was your occupation?
Well, then I was a grocer.
You owned your own store?
Uh-huh. We had two stores, one on Pleasant Heights and one on 8th Street. But I sold those in 1950.
Uh-huh. Do you remember when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yes, that was a Sunday. We were out taking a little Sunday afternoon drive after my nap, and coming back, it came in on the radio about it. I remember saying to my wife, now we're into it. And that was the start of it. And then, of course, the first thing comes is, I think gasoline was the first thing rationed, and sugar was the next. I was caught over Pennsylvania rationing gasoline before Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I was going east, and I had to stop at the barracks beyond Breezewood on the turnpike. Turnpike was just opened a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. Turnpike opened in October, and this was after November, or after December. And I got my A card over there, which allowed me 4 gallon a week.
Would you explain what your A card was?
It was a gasoline card that you had to have punched when you went to get your gas at the station.
Uh-huh.
And then later they come out with stamps.
Uh-huh.
But the first one was a card, and that allowed basic 4 gallon a week, and then if you needed any more and had the right need and they were in the right mood, they would give you more.
Okay. How did the government go about controlling, for example, sugar?
Well, lousy. we were kind of brought up to tell the truth about things. And when we had to send in our amount of sugar we had on hand, we told them how much we had on hand. Now that's when it came loose in 100-pound bags or 365-pound barrels.
Mm-hmm.
You weighed it up yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you got 100-pound, and if you were honest with your customers, you couldn't sell 100-pound out of it, because it's next to impossible to weigh something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And do it, other than being seepage before it gets to you. So it was kind of rough. You had to go out and find ways. Fortunately, I had a friend in Pittsburgh that was a broker for, I can't think of the sugar company now, wasn't Arbuckle's. Anyway, he wiggled me out 10 bags of sugar. That was 1,000 pound, and that kept us going with what we could get. But what the government allotted me wasn't enough to take care of a good day's business, and we couldn't get deliveries every day, of course.
What other products in your store would have been rationed?
Coffee,
mm-hmm.
Meat, cheese went with the meat, that was red stamps. Those were the main items, coffee. Those were the fighting items. But coffee, sugar, meat.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was all. Other things was hard to get, but that was the ration stamps, as I remember.
All right, when the shoppers came into your store, did they have a book of stamps?
They had stamps. For meat, they had a little red thing about as a little smaller than a dime.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they used. And we would deposit them in the bank just like money. We'd make out a deposit slip with so many blue stamps, so many red stamps.
Uh-huh.
And then we had an extra checkbook. And if Armour or Sugardale brought us meat and it took 2,500 stamps, we would write them a check out for 2,500, just as though it was dollars, but it was stamps.
So the stamps that the people turned into you is what you used to keep supply?
We had to put them in books.
Uh-huh.
And then we'd deposit them just like money.
Oh, I see.
My father then was quite old, and he spent half of his time for the two stores putting stamps in books, and then we would deposit them when we went to the bank with the money, and then of course the bank holiday come along, and we couldn't write checks. No matter how much money you had in the bank, you couldn't write a check for those until that particular bank could open. Well, then your suppliers would come in and they'd have a note on it, if possible, pay us with cash or any part of the bill you can pay us.
Because
mm-hmm. Everybody was hard up for cash, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you couldn't get at your checking account or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But it passed over in our town. Our banks were very fortunate. The first and the Potters opened within 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them, of course, they were, and so did Potter Saving and Loan. The Union Savings and Loan didn't open, although they, when they liquidated, they paid $1.07 for every dollar that was in there, so nobody lost anything,
uh-huh.
but they never opened again.
Was this one bank holiday, or?
Just one.
Just one?
It was 3 or 4 days, though.
Do you remember the date?
No.
Okay.
Well, let's see, Roosevelt took office on March 4th, so it was the first thing he'd done, he closed the banks.
Well, this is during the Depression.
Hmm?
This is during the Depression you're talking about. Okay.
Well, he was inaugurated in 1932 on March 4th.
Okay.
So that would be, well, if you want me to guess at it, it would be the 7th or 8th or 9th. It was the first thing he'd done is close the banks. And then they couldn't open until the examiners gave them a permit.
Mm-hmm.
And they, none of them opened less than 3 or 4 days.
Okay, were there any bank holidays during the war?
No.
Okay, just this one particular. Did your customers ever give you a hard time?
Oh, boy.
Would you like to elaborate on that a little bit?
You get the next month? Well, people that got panicky and demanding, for instance, on, we'll say on sugar, we'd get some sugar in and we started, thought we were pretty smart. We'd make a list of all the customers. Then we'd start up at the top and work till the sugar went and give them a pound, and when it was gone, then the next come in, we'd start there where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
But Charlie, possibly's name, was up here next, and he was in the store, and you said, here's your sugar that we've saved for you, and you were standing next there and said, I want some sugar too, and we didn't have any. Then you put your heels into the floor and let us have it. I'm thinking of one lady that Fleshman's Yeast Company sold Jason Sanborn coffee. We didn't buy it from them because they sold to the dealers that couldn't buy as much. We bought ours from the Jason Sanborn Company. And of course, coffee was one of the worst things. And there's a lady waiting for a streetcar right at our, beyond our door, and the yeast man was bringing yeast in to us, Fleshman's Yeast, which, and he was bringing it in a Jason Sanborn case.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't full, but that's mm-hmm. what he, and a lady was getting on the streetcar, and as soon as she got to a phone uptown, she called and asked for me. I want you to save me a pound of Jason Sanborn coffee, and don't you tell me you haven't got it because I just seen him bring it in. Well, I ask everybody in the store, he didn't bring you any Jason Sanborn, did he? We don't get it from him. No, we couldn't figure it. And we couldn't tell her why, and give her an excuse. And finally, when we contacted him, and he says, oh yeah, I brought your yeast in a Jason Sanborn case. Why? but we never told her any difference. We never saw her back.
Oh.
And you'd lose customers for lots of different ways. They'd come in and you didn't have what they want, or you had it in the morning and they didn't have it still when they got there, and you just didn't explain it because they were panicky. The best way I can put it, they talked something like these women from Chester when they talk about WTI. You don't know what they're saying even. But I had stuff thrown at me in the store. I can remember one in particular. I'm not going to repeat all of it. He threw a, we didn't have coffee, and he said he couldn't go to work without coffee, and he had a half a pound package of bacon, and he threw it back at me and told me where to go with it. I didn't go, but he seen the time, he wished I'd had it. But it was a very tough time for the, you see, it would be different now because you don't know the owner of the store.
Mm-hmm.
He's not your neighbor, most mm-hmm. likely, and if it's there, it's there, and if it isn't there, you don't think anything of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have some chain stores in town, but they were small stores too. We had, in our area, we had 10 A&Ps, counting Chester and Newell and East End and downtown. And when they got something short in, they put it out, but they didn't have the fighting that we did, because the best I can explain it is people want to, if they can't hurt you, you can do anything. I asked a man once when he complaining about something that we had in our store, and I said, he had an A&P bag, and I happened to know the manager of the A&P then on Walnut Street. And I said, do you, he told me why they weren't buying from us. This was at the bookstore, though. And I said, do you, your people go to the A&P? And he said, yes, he had us out there. I said, well, we didn't sell beer. They sell beer and wine up there. And you go there. And, well, he said, they're so big they would never miss me. I said, in other words, you're telling me that because I'm a small fella, I have to trip to your tune or you can hurt me. But he can do anything because he's big and you can't hurt him. Of course, he didn't know how to answer me. But people were very, very panicky and mad all the time. And I wouldn't go through it again. But then you'd read in the paper of the casualties. Mm-hmm. And they really didn't mean much. But I was standing beside a clerk when they brought her in the message that her husband was killed. And that changed the war altogether.
Mm-hmm.
See, it wasn't the same war then. It was different. I was standing there with her.
Uh-huh.
And of course, she was all broke up. I told her to go home and come back when she felt like it. But what I'm telling that is, not too long after that, when she was in hearing distance of a woman who said, word for word, if the war lasts 6 more months, we'll be on our feet. And this little girl was usually a very quiet, nice person. She turned on that woman, and did she take her to town. She really took her. And then she came to me crying and says, I'm sorry, but I guess I'm out of a job. I said, you're not out of a job, girlie. You done it better than I could. And of course, we didn't make friends with that lady, but I didn't care about that old. But those are some of the things that the war possibly that brought me pretty close to it, because you see, I was standing there. I wasn't no printed word. There was just, it was a different time to go through. It wasn't like the Vietnam or none of that. It was all of the war. But then, of course, they got checks back from the boys in the army, and of course that was a day when they went to town. Getting back to the Depression, if you don't mind.
Oh no, that's fine.
The city of East Liverpool, like lots of cities, couldn't pay their help, and they gave them scrip.
What is scrip?
It was a money bill, only it wasn't money. It was scrip on the city of East Liverpool. It couldn't be cashed in a bank.
Okay.
We took it in on the bills, and then we had relief orders from the county. The county didn't have any money to pay them. And we were getting to the point that we had a pile of scrip because only the local wholesalers would take it. None of the people that we bought direct from, like Heinz, Procter & Gamble, mm-hmm. and all those people, and the main wholesaler we bought from was from Beaver Falls, they wouldn't take it. And we were to the point we had, when we'd pay for our stuff, there was nothing left. Many a week I went home with nothing because I didn't have anything to pay myself with. And the scrip, it was all good in the county. Then we learned that the county was paying the chain stores. because they demanded it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out. Oh, and then the county said you can pay your taxes with it. They put a notice in the paper that you could pay your taxes with it. Oh boy, I thought I was in clover then. So I went to my customers that had money or some money to pay their taxes. It cost them 50 cents if they'd pay it at the Potter Savings and Loan, and I said, I'll pay your taxes for you, and you'll save the 50 cents if you'll give me the money and let me go out to Lisbon and pay them for you. So I had a couple doctors that paid their taxes with it, and so I got myself all fixed up and as happy as if I had good sense. I had about $2,000 worth of taxes and welfare orders and on my way to Lisbon. And my brother went with me. And he was kind of a quiet fella too, and around me. And we went out there, and a little short so-and-so said, oh, you can only pay your own taxes with this. And I said, come off of it, mister. The paper says you can pay. County will accept county welfare orders for taxes. And I said, it don't say your own or anything else. Not what my check. And he had something smart to say, like as if we were asking for relief. And my brother, being a quiet fellow, reached over and got him like this.
Round his neck, huh?
He says, you little shrimp, we're not out here for welfare, we're out here for what you owe us. Now, you touchy down and give us that check, because you tell us in the newspaper you will. And he was pretty well scared, and after waiting about an hour and a half, we got our check. So you had to resort to all sorts of tricks to mm-hmm. get along if you were in the business and trying to help your customers and stay in business. But then the script from East Liverpool, they paid it off so much at a time, which mm-hmm. they'd done the best they could. The firemen got it, the policemen, the street workers, and so on. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any money to pay with. I often wished I'd have saved a piece of the script and some of the stamps, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be something.
But then we had another problem with the several families with the men out, and several of them would get married just before they go, or a little before they go, and there was a...
You're talking about the war now?
Uh-huh. I'm sorry, I get mixed up.
Oh, that's okay.
My mind drifts like that. But you folks can't realize what those two things was that we lived through. It wasn't good to live through them. We're different.
Mm-hmm.
We don't waste. Silk stockings was something that women actually got into fist fights in the Ogilvy store over stockings.
Did they really?
They'd get a few stockings in. I remember telling my wife when the war started, I worked in the store during the first war, and just as a boy, but I could see what was going on. It wasn't anything near like the second.
Mm-hmm.
It only lasted from April of 1917 till November of 1918.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that didn't get people bad enough to get real mad. But I said, let's start our house by, if we can get it, we'll take it. If we can't get it, we'll do without it and not make ourselves unhappy over it.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we did. She tells me that she got down. So she didn't have a good pair of stockings to put on, but she didn't. She seemed to get by and got. And we quit using coffee at our house. And people would call up our home. She didn't work in the store, so she didn't know many customers.
Mm-hmm.
But the name was in the phone book. And she was called up many, many times. I guess you're getting all the coffee you want. I guess you're getting all the butter you want. And all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. that's the stuff we went through. And
tell Mrs. Smith about when you were on the price board, OPA price board. You were telling
us. I was on the Cleveland area price board. That I was the only merchant on it.
Okay, excuse me, I need you to explain exactly what that was, because I have no idea.
Well, we had price controls, you know, federal price and wage controls.
Uh-huh, okay.
And if something was priced at 25 cents, that's as much as you could charge for it
okay.
without violating the rule. And the wholesale prices was priced too that way, but the it didn't always work that way. If you would turn a wholesaler in, you needed him next week.
Uh-huh.
And we tried to keep our things at price. We had a lady that in her spare time checked prices for both stores, well, no matter what they cost, so we'd stay in order. But when it was on the price board, the division was divided into, the district was divided into divisions. Now our division here met separately from the Cleveland division or district.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lady from Lisbon who, with not too good a reputation, that was chairman. And they would nitpick. If, in other words, as a customer, if you were out of sorts with me, you'd try to find something you could report.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a couple items. I think I told Charlie about them yesterday. That's why they're on my mind. A fella had a little store in East End by Dry Run. Now, just a gas station with it's as big as this room. I'm not too sure about this room. Just a gas station mm-hmm. with some shelves in it.
Okay.
And he was turned in for selling, he was turned in his third time. The last time was for selling a 46-ounce can of tomato juice for 27 cents, and it was ceilinged at 25. So he was brought before the board, and of course, I was the only merchant on the board. So,
mm-hmm.
And this woman said, "You are charged with selling this tomato juice." Yes. I said, "Do you have your bill of what you paid for that?" And he brought me a bill that was at least 3 months old. And there's one case of tomato juice, 12, that's a big can, 46 ounces, mm-hmm. 12 in a case. I said, "You mean this is the last you bought?" And he said, "Oh yes, you know, I don't sell very much. I just have my gas station and a few things." And I said, "Are you sure?" "Yes, I don't. I looked, I'm sure that's the last I bought. Do you have any left?" "Oh, I might have one or two or three cans, I don't know." In other words, you've sold either 8 or 9 cans since you got this. "Yeah." And I said to the woman threatened his third trip there. She said she had the power to close him up. She said, "We're going to have to close you." And I got onto it, and I said, "You're going to close this man that's trying to make a living because he cheated the poor public out of 2 cents a can for 8 or 9 cans over these couple months or so." I said, "What will you do if you have to close the store, Mr. Wood?" Well, he says, "I have no other income." There wasn't Social Security then.
Mm-hmm.
I says, "In other words, you might have to go to the county for help. Is that it?" He says, "Well, I don't know. I don't suppose anybody would give me a job. He's quite old." And then I put up the argument. For 7 or 8 cents, you'd put this man on relief. And she reported me to the Cleveland area for hampering her investigation in this and that. When I went to the next meeting in Cleveland, they brought it up. I says, "We'll settle it all right now. I'm quitting." I walked out.
Did you really? Excuse me.
But we dealt with the armor meat company. They had a place in town here down where the post office is now.
Mm-hmm.
They'd done some smoking of meat there too. And we bought some meat from them. And they made a cleanser, a lighthouse cleanser, that was something, you know what Dutch cleanser is?
Uh-huh.
That's what was like that, but it wouldn't sell. Not worth a hoot. And we didn't even keep it because it wouldn't sell. But somehow, when we'd get an order for meat from Armour, there'd be one or two cases of lighthouse cleanser with it. And if you said anything about it next week, they might have just run out of meat when they got to your order, you know. So these were ganging up in the cellar. I'd hesitate to say how many cases we had of it. It was cheap stuff. So one day we decided not to have it in the shelf. It would leave it off the shelf altogether for 2 or 3 weeks. Then we took some to each store and we made a display of it on the floor with a price on it, and then we put limit two to a customer. Well, that was the magic word. If it was short, buy it, you see?
Yeah.
And about once a month, we'd bring Lighthouse Cleanser out with limit two to a customer, and we got rid of it pretty much that way. That's crooked merchants. Then we had a gas problem getting, we had three trucks, I guess, and an old car that we went between the stores, or to go out and pull one of them out of the ditch with, and we had to make a route out for each delivery route. Say we was going up on this hill on Friday, we had to make a map of the stops that we regularly made here,
mm-hmm.
and what the mileage was when the truck got back that day for that day's routes.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, when that was sent in to some place, they figured at how much gas we should have. And they gave it to us, which of course wasn't anything near enough, because I suppose they figured the same amount of gas for Salem as they did for these hills.
Uh-huh.
So we weren't close to it. And I was up on a little building, the top floor of the building, talking to Harold Barth, who was kind of ahead of the rationing affairs here, and he was something else to deal with. And I looked out the window and seen a Crocker City beer truck going down Market Street. And I said, how do they get along with their gas? Well, they're not rationed. He says, you know, delivering groceries is not a necessity. That was Harold Barth. You had to know him to see it. I says, okay, that's all right. Well, when you went to the city hall to get their rationing books, they would say you have four in a family, so you get this many stamps.
Mm-hmm.
So they would cut the extra stamps out of that book. You understand?
Uh-huh. Right.
So you got your amount, and Charlie had 10 kids, and he got more.
Okay.
Then they'd throw those gas stamps in the... I made a mistake there. I'm talking gas and I'm talking kids. That isn't right. You got 4 gallons of gas was basic for your car.
Right.
If you had a special need, you got additional. If you had to drive to your work or your work meant a car,
uh-huh.
They give you extra.
Right.
So yours would be different than his, maybe.
Okay.
And they trimmed them and threw them in here. Well, these people are all dead now. There was a fellow by the name of Bleninger that was a ceramic engineer at Homer Lachlan, and I knew him and knew his daughter. We were very friendly, and she was the one that trimmed these ration accounts. So every so often, some of those ration stamps didn't get in the waste basket, and I got them.
Oh.
So that put me back in business for my delivery trucks. It was dishonest, but I felt they were dishonest with me, and you fight fire with fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened there. And those are just some of the other things that we had. And tires were also rationed. And I got to needing tires, and I found a place out beyond Salem, one of those little places out there, I can't think of it, and they had a wrecking place out there, and he would take tires off of the cars that he had there while you were there, but they weren't tires that came on that tire car. That was if somebody would come, he made sure he took them off the car so that any inspector or anybody was there. Uh-huh. He was selling you those tires off that car. They weren't new.
Uh-huh.
So that's what kept us in tires. I came back with I think I bought 8 or 10 that day I was out.
Uh-huh.
And they made sure they all was sized. The trucks used the same size tires.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got the... That's how we got along with tires.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And so it was a tricky... you had to always be looking out. Oh, and then I got ahead of meat pretty well. I kept that because you wouldn't get enough. The poor Dickens that had no way of getting any meat except from the wholesalers. They were in an awful shape. They couldn't, you know. You'd get a piece of meat here, a steak, and you'd put it on the scale. At first, you'd take the price of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd take the number of stamps. If it took, I've forgotten the amount, if it took 7 stamps or points for a piece of beefsteak,
uh-huh,
then you'd go to your scale there to the number 7, and on the computer scale, that'd show you how many stamps you needed for that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the way you sold it. But then, knowing a lot of farmers and doing a good bit of farm trade out through the area here, Galan went to Forest West Point, a farmer that would kill a beef and didn't eat it all himself, so I would buy what was left of it, and I didn't give him stamps, because he didn't want them. Or if somebody else was killing a hog, I would buy what was left of it, or maybe he'd just... So I'd have more if I knew him. Well, I can think of one fellow, we were quite friendly. He came there when I was a little boy to the store. My boss bought potatoes and stuff from him. He wanted to dress a couple hogs. He'd dress 2 of them and take what he wanted out of just maybe a ham out of one, so he'd be honest. His conscience was clear. And what he wanted out of the other, and then I'd get the rest of it.
Oh.
And that kept me ahead on red stamps, so I didn't need them.
Oh, good.
So you had to do all kind of things to keep up. And I don't know, you could stretch that out a long time, I would have told you, but basically people were hysterical and unreasonable if they couldn't get something they wanted. See,
mm-hmm,
we're not used to being doing without in our country, and we weren't then either. And then cigarettes was another one. I'm thinking of one particular woman. She hated cigarettes. She'd go on all the time. But her son-in-law smoked. He didn't even live in our area. We hardly knew him. But she would come in and want cigarettes for him. And she wasn't a cigarette customer, you might say. So that meant you didn't have to supply your regular needs of your customers. All your customers were wanting more than their need, either to help somebody else or to get more for themselves. But the easiest way to sell something was try to make believe it was scarce. It's like I told you on the lighthouse.
I'm gonna.
I kind of forgot myself once in a while and put something out there on sale that wasn't scarce.
I'm gonna stop here and turn the tape over. Okay, to continue with this, during the Gulf War last year, all through town we displayed yellow ribbons and we had rallies to show our support toward the boys in the Gulf. Do you remember anything like that happening in East Liverpool?
No, the only thing I remember, there'd be more flags around, and if there was a casualty in a house, they would have a gold star. It was white in the center and surrounded by two bands of red and blue.
Uh-huh.
And then the gold star in the center. They were, if there was a casualty, they used. And then they had an organization called the Gold Star Mothers that met kind of regularly. And then one of the things I've missed was rent controls.
Rent control.
You had to put in, if today was the day, you'd have to put what you were charging for rent today, and that was created your ceiling, and you couldn't charge any more than that. And in some places, if you were caught with rents too low, you'd be stuck with that.
Uh-huh.
And you still had to make necessary repairs. I was called up before the board once. Mr. Wiley from Wheeling was our chief for this area, and he'd be in East Liverpool certain times to answer all the complaints. And a tenant up on East 8th Street, we were stuck with low rent there, and his toilet seat cracked. And he came down and wanted a new toilet seat, and I said, I can't buy you a toilet seat because my ceiling is too low, and I'll give you what they would have cost before the ceiling, but that's all I'll pay you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he reported me. And I told Mr. Wiley I didn't refuse to buy him a new seat. I said I would give him, what it was, $2 or $3 of what it would have cost then. Mm-hmm. And they were much more than that. And he says, well, that's the same as refusing. So we took the next half hour arguing that one out. And then I say most of these people are dead, so I can say anything, can't I?
I guess you can.
We had about 6 or 7 rents that were too low. And my brother and I, his wife was away and I wasn't married. And we got a meeting with Mr. Wiley after his regular meeting in the afternoon, and we said, we have to all eat. Let's go down to the hotel and eat. And then we'll go down to my brother's house because his wife's away and we can take care of these things. What Wiley didn't know was that that afternoon I told the waiter, you keep this fella's glass filled up. And my brother and I didn't drink and he was giving us ginger ale. I guess Wiley's glass would get 2/3 down and he'd be back there filling that up. Again, we got to my brother's house. We were in a pretty good shape. and we explained to him our problem, and he was agreeing with us as much as he could. And we got a little bit of raises on those houses that night. And it, all it cost us was getting Molly's tongue a little thick.
Do you remember having any air raid drills here in East Liverpool?
Anyone?
Air raid drills.
I don't remember of any drills. We had, we put electric boxes out of our stores with a key that the warden in our area was supposed to, should there be a problem, he was supposed to reach up and turn that out,
mm-hmm.
our night lights. But we had no air raids that I can remember of.
What about blackouts? Did you have those?
Oh, we had blackout train. That's why we had a warning to be able to turn these lights out if nobody
uh-huh.
was at the store. And then we put some dark blinds up if you couldn't put your blinds all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
But the stores all had a key box outside that the now up on Pleasant Heights, they had a warden for Pleasant Heights General where the cemeteries are in there, and then a little out La Croft, they had
mm-hmm.
a warden. And his job was to go around and see that the lights were out. And when it come to a store that wasn't open, he
mm-hmm.
had his key that would fit all these boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Box, not much bigger than that, only about three times as thick.
Uh-huh.
And that would have to be within reach of him. But I can't remember any raids. We had training, a couple training sessions of blackouts
uh-huh.
to see that everybody, and then the wardens would check to see if the lights were out.
And what happened if they weren't?
Well, I don't know if anybody, they come and told you about it, but I don't think anybody was penalized for
okay.
it. But I think it was the warden's duty to come to you and say, hey, you didn't have your light out last night.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned ours out because there wouldn't be anybody
uh-huh.
at the store.
What was your impression of President Roosevelt, Eisenhower, and MacArthur?
No, I didn't like him.
Roosevelt?
No.
How did you think he handled
it? I feel he done a great job. I just didn't like some of his tactics. I didn't like his sneak raid on Pearl Harbor when they knew it was coming, 2 or 3 days or 4 days. I didn't like a lot of his alphabetical things. But when he would get on the radio and say, "My friends," everybody got on their knees. He had the charisma that nobody had. He was our Hitler. And don't forget, Hitler is like a German Jew that I knew. He said, as a German, I love Hitler. As a Jew, I hate his guts.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Because he came in and took over after General Hindenburg was made chancellor after the war when he was way in his 80s and he couldn't operate things, and they were eating their dogs and starving, and Hitler come up and promised them something and gave them something. Now,
mm-hmm.
I have no use for Hitler. He was
mm-hmm.
the wickedest man ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
But Roosevelt was our Hitler. He came up when we were in the Depression and he gave us something. And I think broke the pride of the country. He said, "We owe you a living," which I always felt we only owe you the opportunity of making a living. And he done a lot of good things. He had the Works Project Administration, WPA, that done a lot of good things around in our town too. Our city hall was built during that time on federal,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of those alphabetical jobs there. And I'm just trying to think what else. Oh, the stadium down at the West Gate, was that, that was some...
Like government, PWA project.
And they cleaned up parks. And they had 10 men for every 5 that was needed, of course. But they done a lot of work instead of loafing, just getting a food stamp or a, they didn't have food stamps and a relief order. And so that was a good thing. His price controls had to be, of course, price and wage controls. That wasn't too popular because everybody wanted price controls, nobody wanted wage controls, and they have to go together. They can't be separated. But I was never Roosevelt, I know.
What about Eisenhower?
Well, I thought Eisenhower was a wonderful person, but he wasn't a good president. he was an army man that was spending most of his lifetime out of our country and come back, and because he was a hero, he was elected president. He was a Republican, and I'm a Republican, but that don't make any difference. We didn't elect the best man. Stevenson was a much better man.
How did you think Ike was as a general?
As a general, I thought he was a great general. I thought he was right next to MacArthur as far as, of course, I'm a poor one to talk about Army. I was never even in the Army.
Why were you, well, speaking of that, did you get a deferment from World War II? Why weren't you in the Army?
Well, the first Army, I was too young.
Right.
The second Army, the second war in 1941, I was 36 years old.
Okay.
And I had to register, but since I could only see out of one eye then, I was classified as 4F.
Okay.
They'd have to get down pretty far to want me.
Okay. Okay.
That didn't bother me either.
You had mentioned something about a German Jew. Did you know this man during the war?
Yes.
Was he living here?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was he aware of what Hitler was doing to the Jews in
Yes,
Germany?
Because he was over there during the first part of the last part of the First War and the in Hindenburg's reign, and he seen what Hitler done when he was when he came into power. He done something the same as Roosevelt did. He started building highways. He built the first turnpike as we know it today in the world, the Autobahn. He built it, it was found out later he'd done it especially for a military road, and he formed the Volkswagen company, or rather had it done, because he wanted a car built that was available to the working man. And if you remember the bug, that was it. And they made, so he done a lot of good work till he, till his true self came out, and we, the power got the best of him. If, so they were two doing the same thing, only, and both ended up with a war on their hand. So they're pretty much, I'm not trying to compare Hitler with Roosevelt all the way, because Hitler was the wickedest man that ever lived. When he wants to, the millions of people he exterminated, and and some people say that it's a myth, but it was no myth. I saw pictures that was taken after they went into Oswald. Is that it? That one of the
Oswald.
Paul Bloor from Liverpool was in the Army, and his company went in, was going too fast for the Germans to get Oswald cleaned up and done away with, and he brought pictures back that he took of dump truck loads of bodies another place of one of them being dumped, just like it was coal, into a huge ditch that had been bulldozed out. And then they just bulldozed that over, you know. And he had pictures of them, of the furnaces or the gas chambers, and and he enlarged them about like this, and I had them in my hand. So it'd be pretty hard to try to convince me that it didn't happen, the Holocaust. And there's a book written by a Chicago professor of the University of Chicago that says it was all a myth. And we had a minister in our area that believed it and was buying those books or ordering them until our store refused to order them for him when they found out what they were. That said it was a myth. And when that fellow talked to me and tried to tell me it was a myth, when I had pictures in my hand that a man I trusted took, I just told him, you don't have enough breath left to convince me, mister.
How did this German Jew, this friend of yours, how did he get out of Germany?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay.
I do know that he was in my Sunday school class, because up in, pretty much up until the war, ours was a German church. One side of my house was born in Germany.
Oh, really?
And so that's the reason I'm interested something in it. But no, he was caught over there. He got out somehow, I don't know, before the war, before, he couldn't have got out much after the war started. But he got out, but that's a statement he made, word for word, as a German I love him, as a Jew I hate him. And that would be the, of course later on, later when the war started, I don't suppose he had quite the backing he did, but he, if he didn't, the war couldn't keep on with one man. If I have any relations over there, I say they're as much as fault as anybody, because they followed. But he could talk for hours to a huge crowd of people and have them hypnotized, so to speak. And if you look at a picture, and the next time you get a picture of Hitler, look at it real close and long. Look at his eyes. His grandmother, when he was a boy, said, supposedly, that boy's eyes just stopped me. Well, that was his grandmother. And if you look at Hitler, get a close-up picture, his eyes just poke through you almost. He hypnotized you, so to speak. And people would... I never saw them. I wasn't in Germany during that time. I was only in Germany twice, and that was after the war. But they tell me that he would just have the crowd just at attention, you know, for those long, long speeches. I listened to part of them once on radio.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Do you remember VE Day, Victory Over Europe Day?
Oh, yes.
Can you describe what happened when you got the news here?
Well, it was quite a lot of excitement. Everybody knew it was going to be a terrific loss of life. But everybody was excited about it. Of course, you didn't have television, but we had radio that we could get news on. Walter Cronkite was on. He was over there as a war correspondent. And Ernie Powell? Not Ernie Powell. It was Second War. What was the man's name that used to be on? He put out movies.
wasn't ever part of Murrow, but it was down later, I think.
Rupert Murrow was later?
I'm trying to think who...
I can't think of who he was. He was very popular. He was over there, and so we got kept up with news on radio.
Mm-hmm.
We had time to listen. And the newspapers, of course. And it was excitement. People followed the war, but maybe not the same way they did the Desert Storm, because it lasted for 4 years, you know.
Yes.
And casualties, every street, you might say, had its mark on it from it.
Uh-huh.
And every family had somebody likely that was either in it and most likely a casualty.
Uh-huh.
And it was just excitement. When the war ended, everybody went to town, I think must have, because I wanted to bring my mother up to, and I said, if it's anything like the First War, it'll be something. And I went down and brought her up, and I went around and come down Fifth Street, and you come down Fifth Street less than a walk, because just so many people downtown, that hollering and graving and blah, and that was something. You remember that, don't you? 1945?
I don't remember where VE Day was. So
we went, and it was quite exciting. It should have been, of course.
A lot of the revelry, you might as well expect it.
The town was wild, in other words.
Had the town done anything to support the hometown boys in the war?
No, I didn't just get that.
Had East Liverpool itself done anything to show support for the boys from East Liverpool that were in the war?
Well, they built the monument down in front of the City Hall.
Okay.
And that's all of that war. You know. I didn't know of any. I think that's a combination, isn't it? That's all wars, isn't
uh-huh.
that down there. I don't know of anything else that was done. Oh, the war memorial out at the Riverview Cemetery was built for the Civil War, but
uh-huh.
then it's for all war. It was. And it laid. It's a good place to raise mosquitoes till about 30 years ago. They made a beautiful chapel out of it.
Uh-huh.
It was a fellow named, what did Grandin Eckert write? He wrote what was the column that Grandin Eckert wrote in the Review under an anonymous name that was sent to all the boys overseas?
Oh, that was Grandin Grandin Record. He wrote letters to all the boys?
Yeah, well, Grandin Eckert wrote it, but he had a name. He had a pen name.
I forgot what that
I forget what it was, but he wrote those columns in the papers, and people could send them to their kids and relatives and wives and so forth. And if you probably went back to the microfilm at the library in those years, you could probably find some of those. But I'm trying to think of the name.
I can't think of the name he used, but that was Don
Cal
Eckert's
Courier,
father.
I think was the name, wasn't it?
Don who?
Cal Courier. Does that sound like a name?
That sounds something.
He wrote it under a pen name that no one ever knew for many years who it was.
I thought
it was a
local. It was something like Cal Collier.
They're very popular. They were kind of a summer in the news around here.
He tried to write to every serviceman from East Liverpool.
Uh-huh.
And it might have been the same letter. I don't know, but I guess it was.
Okay.
But nobody knew it much till after the war.
I think it was Cal Courier was under the pen name he wrote under, and I think if you look in the paper, you might find it.
That's Don Eckert's father, you said.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, you probably don't know Don Eckert, do you?
No, I don't. But
don't
if
you?
I, no.
His name was Grandin.
Yeah, he had an advertising agency here in town.
Okay. Do you remember hearing about the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima?
Well, just the news from it and how terrible it was. I don't know as I remember anything of great excitement except the headlines in the newspaper and on the radio. Personally, I always felt that our government should have went over and tried to explain it to the Japanese, and this is going to happen if you don't stop this instead of actually dropping it. Maybe it wouldn't have worked, but don't forget we killed the most people at one time than any other time in the history of the world. Because it's questionable to the Great Flood of whether there's that many people in the world or not. Because there's only less than 5 million people in the world during the biblical days. That is known people.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all it was. It was news of it and hoping it would end the thing, but it wasn't too much as I remember.
Well, are you saying then that you, at the time, you did not feel that we should have dropped it, that we should have given them a different warning first?
I didn't agree with it, and don't yet.
Okay.
I agree with it if everything else would have failed, but if they'd have had it, they'd have dropped it. But
no.
I have always thought maybe they should have tried to convince the Japanese government that they had the weapon and it could have been done, because there was another country in these cases is always the in between, like Switzerland and Europe.
Uh-huh.
They were the in between during they weren't in the war, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the in between during the Second War and with Europe. And I always felt, now that's an opinion.
Well, that's fine.
You don't have to agree with it.
When the war was over with and the boys came home, did East Liverpool have any kind of a rally for the returning soldiers?
I don't remember. They'd have parades, of course, on Memorial Day, and they were bigger then than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And but I don't remember anything definitely as planned for them.
Okay. Okay, I'm just about finished here. Is there anything else that you can remember that you think might be important?
Well, I'll be thinking of things for the next 2 or 4 days. Well, down at the Wellsville railroad yards, they got to hiring women. They remember they sang Rosie the Riveter?
Uh-huh.
Well, that started then, because they had women work. I can remember one customer, she was a Cracker Jack. She come from work with her hair bandaged in a bandana and her face dirty and grease, and she wouldn't bother cleaning up before she stopped in the store, and she was a corker. She seen everything funny. But the term then, Rosie the River, started at that time because they didn't have enough men to fill the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they do that at the Midland Mill too?
Virtually every industry was like that.
Uh-huh. And the Wellsville yards done repair work on engines and trains and had a roundhouse there. They hired almost 900 men at one time. But I think of another fellow that I used to torment. He had lots of tools. And they all had PRR on them. And I said to him something about one day, I said, that's my grandfather's initials.
What he's thinking, I was Pennsylvania Railroad.
Oh, I see. Okay. I've got it now. Okay. Pennsylvania Railroad.
It's like some place that I knew of. I don't know where, but it must have been around. They had their light bulbs kind of special made, like on the bottom where they usually have GE 50 watt or something.
Uh-huh.
They had stolen from the Pennsylvania Railroad or something. I just can't think. It's the general things that happen. You oft times you had something break down and it stayed broken until afterwards. We had a You know, we had a truck broke down, we couldn't get parts, and I wound my wife's car out of her and took the all but the driver's seat out of it before she seen what we were doing with it to use in place of a truck, and left her without a car. That was nothing unusual. People had their cars. Any number of people I could name, if I could just have lots of time to think and put another name to it,
mm-hmm.
that didn't jack their cars up.
Mm-hmm.
And not as many as during the Depression, but I just 4 gallon of gas didn't go very far, because although they weren't the big cars we had in the 50s and 60s, they took a whole lot more gas than cars,
uh-huh.
the little cars we have today. You'd have people say, if I give you some gas, will you take us here, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe if we three were going to go someplace tonight, maybe we'd go together and give our stamp to get gas in uh-huh. one car. And all sorts of little tricks you had to do to... Just so many things that you just didn't go out and say, I want this.
Uh-huh.
You had to do without a lot of stuff. And then they made us an imitation coffee during the war. It was made of wheat. What was it called? It was made of wheat, and our postum is made of wheat, but it wasn't postum. Oh, it tasted awful.
It was in sawdust, not pink and sand.
But we didn't sell much of it. It came out. And then oleo and margarine went a great leap forward there. Although it wasn't colored, you can't remember anybody coloring margarine, can you?
No.
You always remember it as being yellow.
Uh-huh.
Well, it came white. Well, you'd come in and ask for a pound of margarine. We had 4 or 5 kinds. It's made of, some of it's made of cottonseed oil, some of it's made of coconut oil.
Mm-hmm.
They called it nut margarine and vegetable margarine.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd open the end of it, and it was wrapped in paper
uh-huh.
inside, and you'd shove your finger in to make an indentation of that paper, and then you'd put a little capsule about that big
uh-huh.
in that for that pound, and then you take that home and you put the margarine out in a bowl and let it get soft, and then you put a pin in this and squeeze it out into this, and then mix that up so that color would be all out around in it, and it'd look more like butter, but it didn't taste nearly as good as our margarines do today.
Uh-huh.
We ate it because we didn't have enough butter to go around, and we ate oleo during the war, and it'd make my wife so mad when somebody'd say, I guess you're getting enough butter, and hang up.
Oh, my.
And when actually we were eating oleo.
Uh-huh.
And then... Right after the war, when butter first was coming, you know, so you could buy uh-huh. 15 or 20 cases if you needed it. And we had an old sulfur cooler. That's what they used to, now it's Freon. It has no smell or taste.
Mm-hmm.
But sulfur, you know what sulfur smells like? If it's,
oh, yes.
Well, this system had sulfur running around in it as a refrigerant. And the coil inside of this cooler one Friday night bursted someplace, and it left all this sulfur out,
mm-hmm.
and it ruined all that butter.
Oh, gee.
And everything in the cooler. I couldn't sell a thing. I hauled it to the dump. But that's not in the war.
And I don't want to interrupt you, but you had an appointment to pick up some food, didn't you, at 4:30? You picking up something at 4:30?
I'm picking up our meal.
Yeah, you were...
Anything else I can do?
Well, I think I'm just about done here. I've got to, unless you've got anything to say, I'm going to end this interview.
Well, as I think, I'll be thinking of it for the next week.
Well, I certainly...
I get to rambling on, and I don't know when to stop.
This has been a great interview. I've enjoyed every minute of it, and I thank you very much
for... You're most welcome. I hope it's done you some good, but I'm a history nut.
Are you?
And this goes right into it, you know.
Well, this concludes my interview with Ed Maloney on World War II, the home front.